Morning, Christian greetings to everyone here this morning. I'd like if we could turn to our theme verse again in 1 Kings 3. Or one theme verse, 1 Kings 3, verse 9. This verse starts with an imperative verb, give. And when we use the word give, we frequently accompany it with the word please. Could you please give this? Or if it's a parent who has the right to command it, we may just say give. Here, I don't think it's strongly understood to be in the imperative, even though it's grammatically that way. It's more of a plea, give. And the request for giving comes from a heart, I think, that felt very small. He calls himself God's servant. He says, I'm in the midst of a people that's great. Give, therefore, thy servant an understanding heart to judge thy people. Sometimes when people say, I would like if you'd give me this or give me that, it might be due to covetousness. And of course, Paul said and wrote in 1 Corinthians 12, right before the love chapter, that we're to covet earnestly the best gifts. And so when we ask God to give us something that is a best gift, that kind of coveting is allowed and actually recommended, commanded. I think this qualifies as a best gift. Give me an understanding heart. I found that there are 11 different Hebrew words that are translated the same way in our King James Version Bibles, and they're all translated as understanding, at least at times. Well, this particular term, the Hebrew term that's used here in 1 Kings 3:9 says, it is defined as meaning to hear intelligently, often with the implication of attention, obedience, etc. In other words, if I understand it, Solomon was asking God to give him a heart that would be able to digest things that he heard and to be able to attach the correct meaning to them so that the right thing would get done. I think that's all involved in this word, an understanding heart. A heart that correctly digests what is heard and is able to attach the correct meaning to what is heard so that the right thing gets done. Well, that certainly sounds like a quality that any dedicated parent or teacher or board member or minister would want to have, I think. Anyone who's in a position like that, like it or not, hears many stories, hears many reports, hears many requests, recommendations, complaints. And it's important for them to be able to hear, intelligently, know what this is that I am hearing, and to be able to then attend properly to what he has heard intelligently. So I'd like to divide this topic this morning along those three avenues. First, hearing, and secondly, hearing intelligently, and thirdly, attending properly to what we hear. Now, first of all, as we think about hearing, this isn't going to be a science lesson on the malleus, incus, and stapes, or the cochlea, or anything like that of the ear. But we do use the word hearing sometimes in that very simple scientific way. We say he's no longer able to hear well. And we're talking about the thing that goes on in our heads, allowing us to register sounds and our brain then being able to turn those sounds into information about our environment. But sometimes we have the posture of hearing, that is, we're looking at a person, or maybe even sort of nodding our heads and trying to put meaningful looks in our eyes to tell that we're hearing. And somebody might still say, "You're not really listening." So there's evidently more to hearing than simply hearing. It seems that hearing has several levels. Well, I would submit this morning that our fast-paced society is training us not to do a very good job of listening. A very good job of hearing. We like things to be self-served so that we don't have to interact with or wait on anybody. That's part of our society. We like drive-thrus. That way we don't have to bestir ourselves from our vehicles. We think we're too busy to disengage from whatever we are doing and simply wholeheartedly give time and attention to somebody else. Shame on us. What's more important in life than other people? Well, too often in my life it's been my schedule or something else. But Jesus put the relationships with people second only to our relationship with God. He said, "And the second is like unto it, thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself," and we could expand it and say, "and as your own thoughts and your own schedule and your own projects." I know what it's like. I sometimes have some things I want to get finished yet before I hurry off to school in the morning, and maybe one of the children has something that he wants to tell me from his day yesterday. Or maybe after I'm at school, a student wants to tell me a story about something that I think I have no interest in. And it's right during my busy, busy time before school gets started, so I keep bustling around maybe and making superficial remarks in response, hoping this won't last too long. Have you all done that with me? Well, hearing is a sacrifice that I am still learning to make, and I'm in my 50s. But you don't have to wait that long to get better at it. I'd like for us to think about a few components of just the hearing part. We said we're going to think of first about the hearing part of understanding hearts. Let's think of some components of hearing. First of all, hearing will take time, but it will not be wasted time. Sometimes it's not that we need to hear the words of the person that is trying to speak to us. It's not so much that we need to hear their words as that we need to interact with that person. Perhaps a child who has a story to tell me doesn't really attach so much importance to the story either. It's just that he simply needs daddy time or mother time or teacher time right now to make his world seem right. He just needs me. And so to tell me something, to talk to me, will be the way to get me with him. He needs an adult. So if we're making his world seem right, well, then hearing a disjointed telling of a story that's from his library book or whatever, even if you never read the book and can't really even put the story together from what the child says, it's not going to be wasted time if what we're doing by hearing is making his world seem right to him because he needs some security of an adult. That's involved in hearing. It'll take time, but it won't be wasted time. Secondly, I'd like to think about how hearing sometimes is done as much with the eyes as with the ears. You've maybe seen examples of this. I can't say for sure that I've seen it in Christian Aid newsletter. Might have been in Five Loaves Ministry or some other newsletters that does work in foreign countries that are oppressive. And sometimes they'll be reporting on conditions in those repressive countries, and they'll maybe even put a photo of someone, a Christian who's spent time in jail or has been being harassed by the police or something. But to protect the security of that individual, do you know what they do to the person's photo? Someone tell me.
They blur the face.
They blur the face, or they print a black band across his eyes. That's enough to conceal his identity. If you can't see a person's eyes, you can't really see the person. The eyes identify. They are so expressive that they speak. And so the eyes tell a person if I am hearing him. Did you ever sit in a church basement while somebody was speaking upstairs without, and so therefore you couldn't see the speaker? Did you ever get the feeling that you were missing it, even though you were hearing it? You weren't seeing the speaker's face, his expressions, his gestures. So you maybe felt as if you were just getting a sort of a 75% treatment. Well, we hear with what we see from the face. So part of hearing people is giving them full, undiverted attention with the eyes, as well as using the ear. The third thing I'd like to mention in relation to hearing, the third aspect of hearing, is that hearing involves transfer of, I'll call them intangible goods. You can't touch them. But something is going from one unique brain to another. Now, I don't just put the word unique any old place, because unique means one. Unique means one, the one and only of that kind. And truly, your brain is unique and mine is unique. No one else has one just like it. And so when something is coming across the sound waves from your unique brain to my unique brain, even though there are lots of similarities, there's no way of communicating all of the nuances of feelings and associations that my brain has about a given set of information to your brain. There's always somewhat of a degree of loss or change. And so, since that is true, many times if we want to be sure or assure a person that we have heard accurately, hearing needs to involve replay. How will a person know if I have heard him? How do I know if I have heard what he meant? Well, one way is to replay. So you're saying this. I told Brother T.J. Bear here, that was responsible for the lodging, about my one experience on the way here. Well, it began before I left, but I had called ahead to arrange for a rental car between the Amtrak station at Eugene and the rental car location. So I reserved the car, but I was going to come into the Amtrak, and I knew that wasn't as popular as an airport, so I didn't think they probably had a, I didn't know if they had a rental station near the track, up to the train station, and I wondered if there was a way to get the car to the Amtrak station, and the lady said, well, you know, they can bring it over. And so before I hung up, I said, well, what's the extra charge for that? Well, she said, there's no charge. Well, we were coming up Amtrak, and the conductor announced that our arrival time at Eugene was going to be thus and thus, which was about, I forget how many minutes later. Then I had told the rental car people I'd be there, and I wanted to make sure they were still going to be open. And so I called to touch base with them again. And I thought I'd better just make sure they had it in their records that I needed to have this car brought to the train station. And the lady said, oh, we can't do that. She said, you would have to have your ID and charge card. We didn't need to see those before we could take the car out. So I told her the lady had told me this. Well, she said, that's never been our policy. We don't do that. Now, what happened in the hearing processes here? Did I hear that lady say there was no charge for doing nothing? Did she not know what I had really asked that they could do? Did she pretend or lie to me? Or I don't know still what went on. Probably I should have replayed. So you're saying that you can do this and this and this. That might have helped. I sort of doubt it, but it might have. But we need to try sometimes when we want to make sure that we've heard correctly, or we want to assure the other person that he is being heard, try a little replay. When I was a boy, my father was employed in a furniture store, and there was a little sign that sort of intrigued me way back then. It went something like this. You maybe have heard this. I know you believe you understand what you think I said, but I am not sure you realize that what you heard is not what I meant. Now, that's just so twisty, you might have to take it in low gear to get through that. But that helps to illustrate the complexity of getting it from here to there. And so some replay can be helpful in hearing. Fourth thing in relation to just hearing is that I would mention is that it cannot happen efficiently. And I think somebody has mentioned this already here at this meeting. It can't happen efficiently when the listener is formulating his next comment while the speaker is still speaking. I think many of us do it in our selfish desire to make sure we come out on top in how this goes. If it's all about anything controversial or we want to make sure that something goes this way instead of that way, we start getting ready with a rebuttal or a reply while the speaker's still speaking. I don't need to use an illustration from anybody else other than myself because I've done it. And I would suspect all of us have done it. I don't enjoy... There was a man that I... But I'm going to give you an illustration anyway from a man that I used to relate to fairly frequently. And he was very knowledgeable. He read widely. But I didn't really enjoy telling him things sometimes because early on in my talk to him, he'd be nodding his head and sort of acting as if he understood me before I'd ever gotten very far. And I had the feeling that I would lose him. Or maybe I'd be interrupted before I was finished. Well, dialogue between me and you, between you and somebody else, is a thought process. It's a thought exercise. And it cannot, is it too strong to say that it cannot be done both wisely and rapidly? Is that too strong? I know we can think rapidly. Can we think correctly and wisely and rapidly? I don't know if I can. I think we need to give the speaker his time and our attention. We might say that wisdom and speed in communication are mutually exclusive. Have the one or have the other, but don't hope to have both. Let's give our thought train to the thoughts of the speaker while he speaks. Give him his time, and ours will be later. Digest it, replay a bit, formulate the reply, and then speak in response. So those are some things that can go along with just plain hearing that will help us to have understanding hearts. Secondly, I'd like to think about the idea of hearing intelligently as the second main division, hearing intelligently. I think there was a hand raise. Well, maybe that was in a workshop. I believe it was in a workshop where someone asked for a hand raise of those who are teachers. Could we do it again? How many are teachers or will be being teachers this year? All right, that's definitely the great majority. So then I'll just say you or we. We fall into the same category as auctioneers and family doctors and the U.S. president. Now, what do we all have in common? Well, we need to know a little about a lot. Were you ever amazed at how many things the auctioneer had names for when it came up for sale?
here came this funny looking gadget you never saw, and he knew what to call it. No, they don't always. They don't always. But they're best off when they know a little about a lot. Even if they don't know the name, they maybe can tell you what it's used for. The family doctor, the general practitioner, needs to know a little about a lot. He maybe doesn't know the latest research, but he knows to whom you should be referred. The U.S. president needs to know a little about a lot. Of course, it's better if he knows a lot about a lot, but a little is a minimum. But then a hobbyist is the opposite. He knows a lot about a little. I'm a rock enthusiast. I like rocks. I collect them. And I'm not ready to say I know a lot about rocks, but I know a lot more than I used to. And that's the way hobbyists are. They know a lot about this area. Specialists in the medical field know a lot about a small area of the care of the body. Mothers need to know a lot about children and child care. But teachers need to know a little about many things if they're going to be able to hear intelligently. Students will bring teachers questions about many topics, and they will expect that since you're a teacher, you will have something to say on their topic. After all, aren't you a book person? So you'll know, won't you? Well, we know our frame. We remember that we are dust, even if the students don't always. We can know only so much. But how can we hear intelligently as part of our desire to have understanding hearts? If we're thinking of hearing intelligently, how can we hear with knowledge? Well, the main answer I'm going to give to that this morning is to care about all areas of pedagogy, about the science of teaching, and the areas of knowledge that we are to teach. Care about and embrace all areas of learning. We tend to have favorite spots and we tend to have flat spots. Generally speaking, a healthy mind is dominant in one hemisphere or the other. Sometimes we call them left brain thinkers or right brain thinkers. Those that are left brain dominant tend to be strong in linguistics, language, speaking, word puzzles, you know, that type of thing. Those that are right brain thinkers tend to be more spatial and concrete in their thinking. So they are the math whizzes and the architects and the scientists and that type of thing. Now that doesn't mean that if you have the one, you have none of the other, but usually the one hemisphere is dominant. And because of that, we tend to have favorite spots and flat spots. We tend to have things that we could spend all day in and other things that it's all right if it's once a year. But when you're a teacher, especially if you're a teacher in our private schools that are too small to usually divide out topics, you know, you're the English man for all up through the grades and you're the math person all up through the grades. We don't normally do that. And so we tend to be general practitioners, and we need to know a little about a lot. Sometimes when students have questions or special needs or special interest in some particular subject, we might have trouble listening intelligently because we give the area so little thought. I grew up from about age 12. On a dairy farm. My father was not a farmer before that. He wanted to have an opportunity to, but didn't. So I have been thankful repeatedly in my school teaching to have had those 8-10 years on a farm, because quite a few of my students were on a farm,
and I could hear and understand and give illustrations more intelligently than if I had never lived on a farm. But I haven't kept really close tabs on farming since I left home. I still live in a farming community. My father is still on a farm. I still go help him once in a while. But I don't know the latest. And farming is changing rapidly. So here comes a student and they begin to talk about a merger or an inverter or a... And those didn't exist when I was on the farm. How can I hear intelligently if I don't care about all areas of learning? Well, if I don't care, I won't have anything I won't have a very easy way of communicating. I'll be starting at ground zero. I'll be starting at the bottom and working up. I maybe won't have any answers for any questions or challenges to give or suggestions or maybe not even any interest. And our listener might be able to tell that. He might see us hearing and think, but he's not really listening. I remember when I was a young man, I went to one of our ministry with some personal troubles, and I was young, but he was older than I was, but he was still a young minister. And I could feel his care for me, but he was honest enough to tell me, and these are about the exact words he said, I'm going to use you as sort of a guinea pig. Well, I didn't really take that very comfortingly. I had some things I wanted help with, and here I was a guinea pig. He had a child, even, he said, that, I don't know, I think he thought that that child showed some inclinations to the troubles I was having, and so he was going to use me as a resource instead of his being my resource. Well, do you call that listening intelligently? And I'm not blaming that young minister, because he was young, he was inexperienced, he had a busy family life, but that's what we're talking about not being. If we can avoid it, when we can avoid it, however we can avoid it, we don't want to give the impression of someone who's listening to the listener, learning from him when he came to ask us or talk to us and converse with us. We want to listen intelligently if we can. How do you do that? The Mennonite Church is finding that if you go about formal education on too high of a level and for too many years, it has proven and it is proving itself to be hazardous. I didn't say fatal, but hazardous to faith. But that doesn't mean we can't keep learning. In fact, much effective learning has been done on an individual basis, and resources abound for safely educating ourselves. So in addition to learning from the teacher guides and the reference books in our schools about the actual material we're going to be teaching from books, what are some things that we shouldn't overlook so that we can hear intelligently, so that almost no matter what a student brings up, we can relate to them in a way that they feel understood? Well, I have about, I don't know, 8 or 10 areas here that I'd like to go across this morning as areas in which we should care about learning. And I'm going to start with one that you might not have thought I would, and that is learning disabilities. Learning disabilities, I'm going to say, are, and you may argue with that, on the rise in general society and among plain people. A couple years ago, I went through one church directory of a Mennonite group, and I found that about 25% of their schools listed a special ed teacher. Now, I've been looking on and off at that church's directories for many years, and I evidently didn't save some of the earliest ones that I would have looked at already. But I'm fairly sure that years ago, let's say 30 years ago, they had very few, if any, special education teachers. Now, we could say, well, that just reflects overdiagnosis. We're just calling things learning disabilities now that we didn't used to call that. Well, I'll grant that could be a possibility to a degree.
But I think as teachers we should be trying to understand what's going on. I was speaking to a teacher from another plain religious group a few years ago, and he's taught longer than I have, and I said, do you think that learning disabilities are on the rise? And without batting an eye, he said, definitely. Allergies are on the rise too. And I haven't done a scientific study of it, but I have become aware by bits and pieces of some things that are likely culprits. It seems quite reasonable to at least attach some of the reason for what's going on. I'll just give you a few possible things. Not because this was a session on this, but this illustrates the kind of learning we should be interested in doing. Is it possible that the processed foods and the chemicals for pest control are filtering into the minds of our children and adults? I'll give you another one that I am sure is a contributor to problems that we should be aware of. This is something we should be willing to learn about. One researcher made a very important point about this less active life. You'd call it sedentary life. That's what you're involved in right now. He said that he used to drive through town and see children out, let's say, climbing trees, riding bikes, and now he doesn't see those children. They're inside playing electronic games or that type of thing. And he went on to say that that lack of exercise means that their mind is receiving less stimulation because our mind develops as it responds to physical stimuli. The sunshine is physical stimuli. The problem is, after a while, the sun goes down and that stimulus stops. Sound is a physical stimulus. After a while, when the night comes on and most of the sounds cease, that stimulus goes away. But he said gravity is the one stimulus that we never leave. Gravity is always affecting us day and night. And one of the primary ways to stimulate the mind. Movement in response to gravity. Every time you take a step, every time you raise your arm, every time you do a chin-up or whatever, you are making your body react properly to the stimulus of gravity, and that means your mind is developing and it's busy. And so when you stop acting in response to gravity, you stop stimulating the mind as much and stop development. So what about the couch potato syndrome? What will that do? It's scary to think about. So we need to understand the need for children to move. And so we won't look at it as some kind of demonic thing when they stretch in their seats. They're responding to stimuli, folks. Maybe. When children seem unable to concentrate, we're thinking about learning disabilities and so on. Well, so they can't concentrate. I can think they're looking at me and then I ask them something and they don't know what I said. What's wrong? Well, we need to be aware of the disabilities that prevent some children from concentration. And we need to be aware that sometimes a punitive measure will fall short of cure. It might even exacerbate things, make things worse, might drive the child to desperation. So we should be aware of some things that can help besides the punitive measure. We maybe need to suggest. I remember one child with learning disabilities that I taught, and his hand was visibly shaking at school during the day, and I found out that he usually began his day with coffee. Now, I don't know that there was a connection. I haven't proven it. There may be none. But we can at least suggest
that certain things are dietary problems, or we can suggest this child could benefit by some neurophysiological exercises or a more structured schedule, or we can try to make that. Recently, the second or third year that I've tried posting my assignments daily on the chalkboard for the benefit of such children. I had always sort of discounted the necessity of doing that, and I think for most normal learners it shouldn't be necessary, but some children with learning disabilities need to see it so they can get it from there to their notebook, and we should be aware of the needs. That's point number one. Things that we should be interested in learning about so we can hear intelligently. And related closely to that, number two, is child development. There are special strengths, there are tendencies, there are weaknesses that go along with each age of child development. I remember being sort of wakened up by reading somewhere that teenagers, even though they are strong, are low in stamina. In other words, if you have them stand for 30 minutes to sing and they begin slouching and leaning against the wall, that might not be poor attitude. They're getting tired. It might be a poor attitude too, but they actually wear out before an adult, even though they might be stronger than the same adult. We ought to know that so we don't attach activities to wrong causes. Did you know that the age of child around six is prone to take literally what you say? They're not developed enough to know that you're speaking allegorically or that you're speaking with a figure of speech. And so first grade teachers should speak very literally because the child about 6 years old takes things at face value. We should learn about those kinds of things, and I haven't learned nearly as many as I should have, nearly as early as I should have. The third area that we should care about so we can hear intelligently, and maybe you're thinking that this doesn't have to do with hearing, this has to do with management. But when we hear information about a person, it's often going to relate to these areas. The third one, I just used the word psychology, but what I mean by that is not advanced psychology courses that are driven by men's perverted theories, but it's still psychology. It's the study of how to relate to different personalities and how to understand various behaviors. The cocky person, is he cocky just for cockiness' sake? Maybe not. It may be a cover-up. The challenging, the shy. In other words, understanding a little bit of the why behind the what. And some of those understandings, if you distrust, and I think you have reason to distrust many modern writers, but not all of them are bad, but some of the older writers like Martin Brumbaugh and Emerson White have written some good books about teaching that I think we can trust very much. And experienced parents and experienced teachers can help us in those understandings. A fourth area that we should care about so we can hear intelligently, I'm calling classroom management. We should study that so that we hear when we hear a report of misbehavior, we hear intelligently. We think of what this might really mean. We know some things of essential tools and some proven techniques. One of my teachers said that teachers teach as they were taught and not as they are taught to teach. Well, then dismiss the institute, huh? Teachers teach as they were taught and not as they were taught to teach. That doesn't mean we don't learn anything, though, at these meetings. But it's a general observation. And I think I've observed some truth in that saying. There was a young teacher that came to the classroom in one of our schools, and the students snatched control away from him. But I have seen that teacher's father sitting in church, seemingly oblivious to what was going on down the bench with his children. And so I guess that young man is teaching as he was taught by his father, regardless of what he was taught when he went to a teacher's institute. His son was, and I can't make this as a blanket statement, but I've just observed it a little bit, so it would seem as if he was at least partly taught by inattention and now maybe teaches that way. The fifth thing that we need to learn about is what I'll call a leader's personas, a leader's, personality, or a leader's, I'm not sure if I can give you any more good synonyms right now, but developing the personality and the personhood of a leader is the idea. I was at a tourist site one time many years ago, and I saw a man wearing something I never forgot. It was a snout cap. The problem was it had two snouts, one going out that way and one going out that way. And on the front of the cap it said, "I'm their leader, which way did they go?" Meant to be humorous, of course, but it's pathetic if that is the way it is in a classroom setting. That's not a leader's persona. Leaders, whether they feel like it or not, must habituate themselves, must get habitual about things like assigning. Don't be bashful. Assign the seats. Assign the work. Assign the reports, the classroom jobs. You're there to do it. Do it. Maybe you've always been sort of laid back and willing to follow. Now it's not that time. It's time to be a leader. Leaders, whether they feel like it or not, must get habituated to organizing. Organizing paper flow, saying where are the papers to go when you're finished, saying how are your notebooks to be arranged, maybe organizing people movement, the breakdown of a project, by this date this is to be done, by this date be here, and so on. And teachers need to habituate themselves to making announcements. In the morning before school, announce the schedule changes that are coming up later in the week, or the materials we'll need to be sure to have in for art class, or the due dates for this or that. Teachers need to get habituated to anticipating, thinking ahead to, getting there before the crowd, not saying, where to get to? No, being there before they have gotten there. Go in front of the line, not at the end. Envision. Teachers need to habituate themselves to keeping children occupied. I'm not comfortable with students saying, I don't have anything to do. What should I do? Well, the school year is too short and the learning is too large for me to get accomplished in their lives everything in the school year. So certainly I need to be a leader enough to keep them occupied. That's something profitable all the time. They shouldn't run out very often. They'll behave better if they're busy. Another thing that we need to care about learning a leader's personas is the last one. Now I'd like to say learning, this is something very simple, maybe. Community news. Children will talk about it. People moving, people starting new occupations. Now, we vary in personality. I tend to be a bit absent-minded. I tend to be too self-centered. So I don't do as well as I should in knowing all the changing demographics of our church. But I try to keep up somewhat. I like to know or find out where my students live. We live in a large valley with hundreds and hundreds of members, and so that's not as simple for me as it might be for some of you. People are constantly changing occupations and addresses, but the more that we can connect to such things, the more we can listen to our children and understand their stories. If your church paper has an obituary and change of address and a birth of infants column, we'll look over it and keep a bit abreast of community news. Learn about it. Next one I would mention, that we should learn so we can hear intelligently and communicate with our children well and understand them, is learn local geographical and historical and natural information. Do you know where there are some caves in your area? Or do you know which streams cut across this part of the community? And do you know the names of the mountains that you look at every day? Do you ever explore roads to just see where that road goes? Get into all parts of your community, off to the side where some of the students might live and want to talk to you about later. And don't overlook the tourist attractions in your home area, the local caverns and museums. Another area that we should learn about, and don't feel overwhelmed, pick one or two, work on them, but just keep them in the back of your mind in case you ever don't feel like you have anything to do. I'll mention politics. Now, I used to be up on that more than I am. Now, I guess I'm feeling that there are some other things that deserve my attention more. But we should try to know some of our local politicians' names and important issues on the national scene. I've noticed some children come to school much more aware of that kind of thing than children from other families. So suppose one of them wants to tell you something that he read or heard. Well, if we don't act completely at a loss, our conversation will go better. Next, I think we should be careful about learning church history and church work. Know the names of many different church organizations and mission outreaches and publishing houses and publications and dates and places of importance in the local area and so on. This one I've already alluded to a bit. The next one I have on my list is occupational terms and practices. Now, I understand that there's very little dairying in this area. I wonder how many of your students here in Oregon know what a fresh cow is. I am not sure if my children all know yet or not. I'd better get them educated. But I grew up on a farm, and I knew what that was, of course. How many of you school teachers, especially on the sister sides, know what the truck's fifth wheel is? If students come to you from a greenhouse family and they're talking about transplanting the seedlings, does that bring any pictures at all to your mind, or are you not really sure what that is about? You know, we need to get familiar with a wide range of vocations and occupational terms so that we can visit here. First aid is another thing. We should care about learning a little of it. There'll be a skin knee and a broken tooth sometime in your classroom, maybe. And if you know how to cool things down or patch things up, how to comfort a sick child, there are so many things to learn. Not only to learn, but to collect. I think teachers must constantly gather and collect. If you aren't a collector yet, become one. I love to pick up curios, odds and ends of things like things that are maybe were common in my childhood and are no more, and shown to my students, see if they know what it looks like. My father has a rectangular pitch pipe. It's about that long. It's not a harmonica, but it's sort of the shape of a harmonica, but has only one row of holes for pitches. And I like to show that to my students. Gather up. Learn so you can hear intelligently. Last, briefly, part three, attending properly to what we hear. And I have only four things briefly to offer that are typical good things to do to follow up listening. After all, what good is it if we take time and effort to hear and hear intelligently but never do anything with what we have heard? Will people consider that we have understanding hearts? Well, first I would mention that with some needs that people want to talk to you about, on the more serious side of those needs might be your response that you'll commit yourself to prayer. You're going to pray about that. That'll let them know you care. Let the needy ones know that you're going to be praying for what you should do to help them or their welfare. Secondly, with some of the needs that are around you, that you hear about, you will need to make some notes and keep them with your list of things to do. You might hear of someone who's needing more coaching. You might hear of a clique that needs to be broken up. Or you might hear of times or places of misbehavior that need your closer monitoring. So you can't remember everything. Make notes. Number three, with some need that you hear about, you'll need to ask for other people's advice or time to think about it. I would frequently, as a principal, tell people that I would check with the school board. Or sometimes I'd say, let me think it over and I'll get back to you, and then we need to do that promptly. On a very practical level, sometimes students ask for assistance with their research or their homework. Sometimes they ask questions we can't answer. But it is a child who needs our help. And we shouldn't just glibly say, well, I wish I knew, but I just don't know. If they cared enough to come ask you, somebody's wondering if you care about that. So to show that you do, do some research, visit the library, call around. And then when we return with the answer, somebody will know he was heard. I've titled my closing poem, A Servant's Supplication. An understanding heart, O Lord, is what I need, to kindly lend an ear, and thoughtfully to hear, and then in dedicated service to proceed, to render aid and care, support and fervent prayer. An understanding heart, O Lord, is what I need.